So back to the evidence of the New Testament in the light of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the story of Jesus and his brother James and John the Baptist. Now, it tells us in the New Testament that everybody wondered whether John the Baptist was the Messiah. And the reason they wondered that is because indeed he was. He was the priestly Messiah. He was the one pillar that had to be in place. He was the founder and leader of the movement at the time when things were coming to a head. Everyone believed the end of the world was coming. That didn't mean the end of the world in a spiritual sense. It meant that they believed the Romans, the Kittim, were going to be thrown out and they were going to get self-determination and God, Yahweh, would rule over them. And John the Baptist was the leader of this. And he identified Jesus as the man that was ideal to become the kingly Messiah, and he baptized Jesus. And they were intended to be these two pillars, and things were looking pretty good for them. But the Romans knew that the Jews were a difficult people. They'd used the Jews a lot. They made great mercenaries. They were always great fighters. And there were Roman legions made up of Jewish soldiers, who had very, very impressive records, but they also knew that when the Jews got niggled, they were bad news. So the Romans had to keep a very close eye on this little corner of their empire. And they, of course, beheaded John the Baptist in 32 AD, which left a problem. Now, we believe that Jesus was in the wilderness for 3 years. It tells us in the Bible 40 days, 40 nights, but there's no explanation for 3 years. He stayed away for 3 years. We know from the Dead Sea Scrolls that the wilderness was a term for Qumran. That's what they called it. So we believe that Jesus and his brother James were both there undergoing their training, if you like, for 3 years for the three degrees that they had to move through, just as modern Freemasons do, with the final degree being a resurrection ceremony to make them a full member of the inner sanctum of the elite, which would equate to being a Master Mason in Freemasonry today. So between 27 and 31, that's what Jesus was doing, and that is why there's no record of anything happening. When John the Baptist was killed, Jesus did something quite remarkable, we believe. He must have been one hell of a guy, because he said, "I'm going to be both pillars." That's one good way of putting it, wasn't it, really? He was going to be both pillars. And his brother James said, "No, you can't do that. I'm going to be the priestly pillar. You stay as the kingly pillar." Now, James was very much like John the Baptist. He spent all day on his knees, had calluses all over his knees from praying, washing permanently, praying permanently. I mean, he really was a holy man. I mean, James the Just, the teacher of righteousness, the leader of the Qumran community. He really was extremely well qualified to become the priestly pillar. But Jesus thought, "No, I can get this job done much better if it's just me being the one Messiah." And he was nearly right. But Jesus wasn't a fluffy, lovey-dovey, softy at all. I mean, you only need to look at to read the New Testament with some degree of objectivity to realize that. I mean, the first thing he did was to get a gang of minders behind him, some toughies, that would sort things out. He got James and John, the sons of thunder. You can imagine what they look like. He got Simon the Zealot and Simon the Terrorist and Judas the Knife Man. I mean, do these sound like cuddly people? No, they were preparing for war. They were preparing to throw the Romans out. They knew they could do it. They knew God would be behind them if they were holy enough. But Jesus had this inspirational thought. He must have been just fantastic, because he had this little sensible idea that Yahweh wouldn't rule over them if some people weren't being holy. It's all right, these little bunch of holy men washing and mumbling around on their knees all day, but what about the rest of the people? The women and the married men and scum like that. You know, the lowest of the low. They were ignored by these holy men, and Jesus said, "We can't ignore them. Unless they're holy too, we've had it. You know, we've got to go for this and go for it quickly. And he decided that if he was going to win, he needed cash and he needed troops, which is pretty sensible. So he went to where the money was. He went to the people that had money, tax collectors. It says in the Bible, everyone was really upset because he was mixing with these terrible people. But they were the ones with money. It says with drunkards and harlots, but really that was just insults that were thrown at people who spoke to Romans. If a woman spoke to a Roman, she was called a harlot. So it didn't really mean literally that they were prostitutes or anything. So Jesus decided to get massive followings behind him because he needed people to mobilize, and he needed money to carry through his idea of throwing the Romans out and creating this kingdom of heaven in Jerusalem. Some people have said that he was actually trying to unseat Rome and make Jerusalem the center of the world, but that seems extremely unlikely. I think their interest was purely their homeland, the Holy Land. They didn't really care what happened elsewhere. Now, the first thing he did, the first miracle that Jesus did, was that he went to a wedding in Cana, and there he turned water into wine, which is a great party trick. You can be really popular with that one. But really, doesn't that sound trivial? But we know from the Dead Sea Scrolls that there was an expression at the time, you can't turn water into wine, which is what they said to Jesus. He said, I'm going to take these people and make them my followers, these women and married men and diseased people. You know, that was unheard of. They were considered to be the water, the common material. You can't turn those commoners into something special. It's a bit like you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. And he said, just you watch me. And he went to a wedding, which was must have been a major wedding at the time. And he turned water into wine, in that he took ordinary people and made them his followers. And no doubt he was showing them the rituals, which he wasn't allowed to do. As the Mandians were saying, he was betraying the secrets that were entrusted to him, because he was showing these ordinary unclean people these rituals. He was baptizing the lower order of them, and certain of the higher ones he was actually showing the resurrection ritual. So he was gathering a sub-cult, if you like, together, which sat within the Qumran community. And we can see in the New Testament the battles that resulted between James and the family of Jesus. I mean, they fell out in chunks, and Jesus was really quite marginalized. So most of the miracles are explainable. Now, the whole idea that Jesus went around raising the dead is the error of the Hellenized people of the Roman Empire, who took as literal truths Jewish terms which were never meant to be taken literally. And of course he was going around resurrecting people to admit them into the Jerusalem church, into his order, just as Freemasons do today. But it's not literal, and it is a fact that the community called the people inside, as all Jewish communities did at the time, they called themselves the living, and everyone outside was the dead. And that was just a term. And we know that because Jesus said strange things which make no sense, which are still retained in the Bible, when he said to somebody who asked if he could go home to bury their father who had just died, and he said, no, let the dead bury the dead. Let the dead bury the dead. Well, I mean, what does that mean? But once you understand, he was just saying, leave that to them. We've got business here. He told people to hate their families. He told them to deny their families, to concentrate on the business that they were conducting. A good example is the story of Ananias and Sapphira, of how that was misunderstood. After the crucifixion, everyone was required to sell their possessions, to get money together, to mobilize the party from a pretty tough situation. And Ananias and Sapphira sold their house, but if you recall, they kept back some of the money. And they were called in to explain this. First Ananias came in, and he was struck down dead, it seems. Just no one hit him or did anything. He just dropped down dead. And then his wife, Sapphira, came in, and the same thing happened. When confronted with this guilt, she just dropped down dead and were carried out. Now, either a mean-minded God stuck out on the finger and killed those two people because they weren't supporting his favourite team quite strongly enough, which seems not very godlike to me, or they were thrown out of the order. They were sent amongst the dead because they'd cheated. They'd kept some money back, and that was against the rules. So when it says they were dead, it doesn't mean it literally, but they were just thrown out, which is a pretty severe punishment when you believe that the new age was coming and that the kingdom of heaven was going to be there and they weren't going to be part of it. So it wasn't a literal truth. Now, just to turn to the actual character of or the personage of Jesus for a minute, there is one surviving description of him, or allegedly a description of the man, who must have been enormously charismatic. We can't be certain whether it's true or not, but Josephus described him in a Slavonic text which survived the attempts to remove all evidence at the time. And he was described in a wanted poster as, the Romans did want him, a man of simple appearance, mature age, dark skin, small stature, 3 cubits high. That's about 4 foot 6 inches. Hunched back, with a long face, long nose, meeting eyebrows, so those that see him would be affrighted. With scanty hair and the parting in the middle of his head, after the manner of the Nazarites, and with an underdeveloped beard. Now, if this guy was really born in a stable and not a palace, why does he have to look like a Greek god? All rippling muscles. Why not? You know, that is quite likely to be true. And there are a couple of parts in the New Testament which do seem to indicate that he was an extraordinarily small man, even by the standards of the day. So, but there's no reason why not. You know, the need to be beautiful was quite a foreign idea to the Jews. He's known and he's described in the Book of Revelations as the bright star of the morning, and his whole plan was to fulfill the star prophecy, and he structured everything to meet the prophecy originally constructed by Ezekiel, that he would be the prince that would march forth and create this kingdom of God on earth. Now, he decided to prompt the Romans into action. He went and he kicked the temple around a bit, the moneylenders. Then he disappeared off to the east of Bethany and then returned again towards and camped in the Garden of Gethsemane. And the Romans by this point were pretty fed up. The Jews were at it again and they had to do something about it. But whilst they were camped on this special morning, his timing was perfect. He had to have the morning star rising behind him. And what many people probably don't realise is that Garden of Gethsemane is exactly in front of the two pillars of the temple in Jerusalem, just across the hillside. So he was looking at this Roman-occupied, because the fortress with Roman soldiers, Panatonia, was actually a part of the same temple building. He was that close to the Romans, and he was in front of the two pillars. And it's described in the prophecies of how he would swoop in between the pillars and take the place, and it would ignite the whole war against the Romans and they would win. His timing was perfect. It had to be on this one morning with the star rising behind him, as indeed it was, if we checked out the state of the sky in Jerusalem at that time. But he took this opportunity, just before dawn, to conduct a Masonic, or what we would now call a Masonic ritual. It belonged to them, of course. Then it's been adopted by Freemasonry since. Because it tells us in Mark 14:51-52, "And there followed him a certain young man, having a linen cloth cast about his naked body. And the young man laid hold on them, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked." So as the Romans arrived, there was this young man wrapped in this cloth. Now Freemasons and their resurrection ceremony are wrapped in a shroud. Now that is exactly what we believe what this young man was doing. He was being admitted at the last minute to the higher order for the battle that was about to start. And the Romans came at the exact moment, perhaps rather unexpectedly, to arrest Jesus. Now, coming to the arrest, we believe that the Romans arrested both pillars, both messiahs. James, the brother of Jesus, who was claiming to be the priestly messiah, at odds with Jesus' claim to be both. So the Romans thought, let's sort this out, we'll arrest them both. And Pontius Pilate decided that he had to remove one, but he didn't need to remove both. If he'd have killed both, there'd have probably been a riot on the spot, and he'd been swinging from the walls before reinforcements could have got there to help the day. So he decided to do the wise thing and just topple one of those pillars, as they had done before with John the Baptist. Now, the reason that we believe that James was also arrested and put on trial is the name Barabbas. Now, you'll recall that Barabbas was arrested on a charge of treason, much the same charge that Jesus was on. And Barabbas quite simply means son of God. Bar, son of, Abba, father, literally son of the father, son of God. The Bible used to record, it was written out, removed a long time ago because it was a little bit inconvenient, but Barabbas, it was called Jesus Barabbas. So Jesus, son of God, walked free. Jesus, King of the Jews, was crucified. So Jesus, son of God, was the priestly pillar. Jesus, King of the Jews, was the kingly pillar. They only needed to topple one. And Pontius Pilate knew that I might as well let the most unpopular one go because that's going to cause less problems. So he asked the crowd, which one do you want spared? Which was a very good way because the vast majority of people were supporters of James. And so they called for Barabbas. There's nothing perverse about it. They weren't calling for some criminal to be released. Why would they do that? No, they were calling for James, the teacher of righteousness, to be released, and Jesus, the upstart, to die. This makes a whole lot more sense. And we found a remarkable passage in an obscure Jewish text, which refers, we believe, to this occasion very clearly in our view. It says that two priests who were brothers were running neck and neck up a ramp, and one of them got within 4 cubits of the altar before the other. So one was leading the other. He took a knife, the one used for killing the sacrificial animals, and stuck it in his own heart. The paschal lamb, the sacrificial lamb. The altar in the temple at Jerusalem, in Herod's temple, had a long ramp going up to it. So it was a description of the race for these two brothers to achieve their goal. One saying he's joint Messiah and one to say he's the lone Messiah. And then it says afterwards that Rabbi Sadek, that is the teacher of righteousness, came and stood on the steps of the portico of the Temple of the Mount and said, "Hear me out, O brothers of ours, house of Israel. Lo, it says, when a corpse is found, and a body is found, and your elders and judges go forth and measure, now as it were to us, whither and whence shall we measure? To the sanctuary or to the courtyard?" And the people groaned and wept after what he had said. Now that ramp only existed for a small number of years at that time, because it was a new temple, of course. That was a reference by the teacher of righteousness, by James the Just, to the book of Deuteronomy, where it explains the rules for identifying the responsibility for a killing. Where a body was found in the open, they would measure to the nearest town. Whichever was the nearest town, they would get the elders out and require them to slay an ox that had never pulled a yoke and dip their hands in the blood and wash it. Their hands in blood over and saying, "I know nothing of this murder. We are innocent of this murder." And so he's saying, where shall we measure? To the sanctuary or to the courtyard? The people he was addressing were in the courtyard. The sanctuary is where the Sanhedrin were. He's saying, shall we blame them or do I blame you for taking part in this decision? And they wept when they realized that their teacher of righteousness was blaming them for the crucifixion of Jesus. because it was his brother, and most important of all, he was one of them, and they should not have sided with anyone for the Romans' sake.